Welcome, welcome. Good evening, folks, and welcome to another session of Career Talks. As always, I'm your host, Orlando Haynes, and I'm going to be branded by saying this over and over, week over week, but I absolutely love what I do and having the opportunity to have amazing guests. And I do not sell the audience short because I consistently get these amazing individuals that are doing great things in the space of career development. So we can think differently. So we can elevate our brand and just really live our best life in our career and whatever, channel you choose. So without further ado, I have the author of a new book called Betting on You. She is a sought after speaker in the HR space, former HR leader. I don't sure if she's ever used the word recovering HR. I know a lot of HR practitioners tend to do that once they exit, but she's absolutely authentic, amazing, shoot straight from the hip. If you don't know who Miss Laurie Ruderman is, you need to know. And let me bring her on.
Oh my goodness, what an introduction. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. I know you're just super busy. So you're sought after. This is what happens. This is the path you chose. And it's absolutely an honor for me to have you on.
Well, I'm not too busy for you, Orlando. I'm a fan. We've got a bunch of mutual friends. Absolutely. You're an esteemed author yourself, a speaker in your own right. So I feel like this is where I need to be tonight, hanging with the cool guy that you are. So thanks for having me.
I love it. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So let's share with folks who don't know who you are, what you do, what you bring. Go ahead and share with the listeners.
Well, everybody, I am indeed Laurie Ruderman, and I've never called myself a recovering HR practitioner because I keep getting sucked in a lot of ways, you know, so it's like not even so far gone that I'm recovered. I'm still, you know, kind of involved. So I do some consulting, coaching, writing, speaking, and I just talk about the world of work, labor, and the economy. And I advise big HR technology companies, CEOs, startups, you know, anybody who wants to think differently about the world of work and the employee experience. And so as I was thinking about what to do next with my career, I've always wanted to write a big girl book, but I didn't want to write some boring HR book. That's not me. And so I thought, well, I want to write about the employee experience for employees. So how do I do that? And I went on this journey to really explore what can I offer that's different. And what's different for me is that I think we don't look to HR to fix our problems. We fix work by fixing ourselves first. And so that's the thesis of my book. And as I started to explore it, Orlando, anytime I made any advancement in my career, it was through difficulty, it was through failure, but it was because I did it and I didn't look to other people to solve my problems. So I'll stop there because that's my take on the world. Like nobody fixes your problem like you, and you just have to give yourself permission and a framework to tackle it.
Okay, so with that, and I love that concept and that path that you took, so which led you to write this book called Betting on You. Yeah. What was the first thing that kind of, where was that epiphany for you, right? Where was that epiphany like, I can't lean to outside resources, no pun intended for human resources, folks. It's just like, did you have an epiphany that said, I'm the issue here in this space, mm-hmm. or I just got to get me right before I approach anyone else seeking support. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, years ago, I had a bunch of corporate jobs and I was not a good fit, but I had a bunch of student loan debt and I didn't want to go into HR. I just kind of fell into it. And that's called a happenstance career. Many of us have it, whether we work in HR, procurement, or marketing, we just kind of fall into it and it becomes the thing that we do. And so I had this happenstance career. And it's almost like I had Stockholm syndrome. The more I hated it and wanted to get away from it, the more I felt like I had to prove myself. And for what? For more money, for more attention, for more love? I don't know. And I was working for a company called Pfizer, and they were going through a big transition at the time. And I was laying people off, flying all over the world to do this because I'm 5 foot tall, I'm blonde, nobody's going to get mad at me. And I'm at an airport one night, and I had previously sneezed and thrown out my back. I wasn't even 30. And I was eating Starburst for dinner and drinking Pepsi, you know, because I'm in between flights. Mm-hmm. And I felt miserable. I'm reading Us Weekly because I'm just too tired to read anything about HR or work or go back to school. And I just had this moment at the airport, like, I cannot do this anymore. You know, there are all these people out there living their best lives. Why not me? Why am I reading about Miley Cyrus or Courtney Love or anybody who was famous back then living these great lives? Why them and why not me? Why does Pfizer always survive even after layoffs, even after a pivot in the marketplace? Because they put themselves first. So once I kind of started to figure out that I was the problem, I had to figure out how I would be the solution. And that's what the book is all about. So yeah, I'm so basic. You know, I had a breakdown at an airport, like probably everybody else in America. But I like to say I was burned out before it was a thing.
Wow. Wow. So how would you coach someone on that? Right? Because obviously there's so many folks going through it. Yeah. And that also has a hint of imposter syndrome a little bit.
Sure. Yeah.
So how do you coach someone to turn around? It's like you can, it's all the phrases in the world. Have faith, right? Yeah. Have the confidence in yourself, self-motivation, but to really bet on yourself. Yes. And then take action is another thing.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. So in the book, I offer a framework to do this. And first of all, I want to say, you know, Barack Obama said, you know, what are you waiting for? You know, we are the people we've been waiting for. We are the change we want to see in the world, right? I mean, that's Gandhi, that's Barack Obama, that's all these people. Mm-hmm. Like the cavalry is not coming. And you kind of don't know that until you've hit your version of rock bottom. But you don't have to hit rock bottom. You can just hit a bump and realize intellectually, all right, I need to stop myself here. I need to do things differently. And so in the book, I try to teach people that there are four paths that they can take to really avoid burnout, to avoid exhaustion, to avoid career derailment, and to bet on themselves and move forward. And the first is this idea of self-leadership, individual accountability. It's the art and science of just owning your life and owning your career, showing up, being resilient, working hard, having a work ethic. Because when you are a self-leader, the world isn't on your case. The world isn't asking you to work 60 hours. They'll take your 40 hours because it's great. You're a self-leader. You show up and you do what you need to do. The second path is well-being. You know, a lot of us before the pandemic and even during the pandemic were commuting long hours, not taking care of ourselves, not eating right. And then lockdown hit and things either got better or they got worse. And nobody can address your well-being but you, even in a corporate environment. So you need to prioritize this. The third piece is learning. I have people focus on. Because if you're not learning, you're not growing. And if you're not growing, what's the point of life? And all the research out there shows that happy employees are employees who are learning. And then finally, I teach a methodology to take a risk because you can't change your life without taking risks. So I teach this idea of de-risking a decision in the book to help you just come out ahead. So those four things. But that's all stuff in the book, right? I will just tell everybody out there that chaos begins and ends in your Outlook calendar, in your Gmail calendar. So you don't need to buy my book, but you do need to go into that calendar and understand how your day is falling apart. Because Orlando, I don't know about you, but I hear it all day long. People say to me, I didn't have time to go to the bathroom. I'm like, your bathroom is right there. You know, like, what is wrong with you? You're a grown adult. So chaos begins and ends in the Gmail calendar. And so I teach people to really go in there and to be rigorous and to be structured. So.
Love it. Love it. So I want to break some of those down.
Long answer. I'm sorry.
And just make a brief correction. You do need to buy Lori's book. Yes, you do.
Okay.
I would love an autographed copy. So I'll buy one, send it to you, send it back.
It's on its way to you, Orlando. Your money's no good with me.
So I love the take risk, right? So that's going to force someone to break through some of their fears.
For sure.
I think that's probably one of the toughest ones in that four pillar breakdown, taking right. Even you just hit it. Someone's so shackled, filled to their desk or to the cubicle that they feel they can't even go to the bathroom. Like there's an unforeseen force of pressure that can be externally given from our employers and management, or internally because is that imposter syndrome again, or it's just they feel they just self-sabotage sometimes. So how do you develop the risk factor? How do you de-risk that? Like, what's that breakdown?
Yeah, it's so hard. And I think this is my own journey, you know, and one of the things that I've learned is that I would get so frustrated that I would almost go and work against myself. I would take a risk. Just, I'm like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to jump into the deep end. And I would jump into the deep end and almost drown. And that's because I had no practice at taking risks. So I always tell people, you practice in the small moments to get good and nail it in the big moments. So you don't tell your CEO everything you think that's wrong with the company. Instead, you start to talk to your colleagues, you develop ideas, you figure out how to say things in a way that are effective. And then maybe you have a conversation with your boss based on that, but you do it in a very targeted way. But in the book, I teach this idea of a pre-mortem. People know what a post-mortem is. You do something, it fails, and then you assign blame, basically. And then you start that thing over and you never look at that binder on the shelf or the memo that assigned blame. You're an optimist. So instead, I teach people that if you're worried about failure, you think you're dumb, you think you're not going to do well in an interview, you think you're going to fail at a project, let's test this out ahead of time. So what I invite people to do is get a piece of paper and a pen. We go old school. We set a timer for about a minute or two. That's right. And you think about that scenario where you're pretty sure you're going to fail and you use your imagination and you write all of it down. So let's say we want to interview Orlando for like a chief HR officer job, right? At the top of an organization. Well, how will that fail? Well, maybe I'm not a good storyteller. Maybe I don't make great eye contact. Maybe I get sweaty. Maybe I don't have the skills necessary and I'm not really sure of what I have to offer. Maybe I don't have my recommendations in order and my references aren't quite there. Maybe I need to get my MBA first. So you write down all the different ways that you think you're going to fail just for a minute. You don't need to belabor it. And when the timer goes up, you look at that list and you think, what's realistic? How am I going to fail? And what's just an irrational fear? So if you're sweaty, you can fix that. If you're, you know, not a good storyteller, you can practice. If you de-risk the thing before you do it, you give yourself a 30% greater chance of success. That's a competitive advantage that your competitors don't have. So why wouldn't you do a pre-mortem and try to de-risk this thing? Because Orlando, if you're going to fail, let it be for something surprising and interesting, not the same stupid thing you fail with over and over again. I can't tell you how many times people say to me, I want to interview for this really important job. They don't prep. They don't do their homework. They don't have a good story about why they want the job. And then they're surprised when they don't get it. And they walk around with this imposter syndrome, like, oh, I'm terrible. Well, maybe do yourself a favor and de-risk it before you interview. So that's the pre-mortem. And you can use it for an interview. You can use it for a project. You can use it on a team. You can all brainstorm the ways you're going to fail. But I like to use it with my husband before we go on a trip. How is this going to fail? We were going to renovate our kitchen. How would that fail? Well, I can't stick to a budget. So already we know. Terrible.
No, I can't see this.
But at least we're talking about these things, right? So the pre-mortem is all about flashing forward in a contained way and then taking action so you don't spiral into depression.
Wow. I love that because basically, yeah, I want to say basically, but you're reverse engineering your fear.
That's right.
So you can unpack that and then you're like, oh, okay, let me just take action. But it sounds very, very simple when you break it down that way.
It is.
We still block ourselves.
Yeah, we do. Aren't we our own worst enemies? I know I was for so many years. And, you know, even when I left corporate America, I started my own business. And it turns out I'm a terrible business person. I'm like, what? People aren't going to knock on my door and just give me business? Like, I don't know these things. So I definitely got the MBA from the School of Hard Knocks, you know? And so I write about that in the book. Like, what? Not everybody thinks I'm gregarious and interesting? Come on now. So I learned the hard way about marketing, about sales, about providing a service, really making other people the center of my business and not just me. You know, nobody cares about me, but they care about how I make them feel and what problems I'm going to solve. So I learned all of this. I write about that in the book, about money management in the book, because if you don't have your money right, you can't do anything in this world. And I learned that firsthand. So yeah, I mean, I'm quite proud of it, but I'm also a little embarrassed about how dumb I am. So I wrote the book as a lesson on how to not be dumb like me. There you go.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. And I love the tweet you made. It might have been this morning. Tax time. It was a tax time tweet. Oh. I was like, that is so true.
God, tax day is terrible. Well, you know, for years I was a sole proprietor and, you know, my money was all commingled and it was messy. And so I started an S corp. But to get me to even understand what an S corp was as an HR lady, I'm like, I need to study this. Okay. So, but I got a business manager. I had somebody take care of my money and help me with it and really talk me through this. And so now I file a corporate return with my tax accountant, and then I file an individual return. And I just, like, I've made my life so much easier because I'm running it like a business. And that's part of what I write about in the book. So many people just hate their job and they're like, I'm going to bet on myself. I'm going to be a consultant. It's like, whoa, slow down. Because running a business is different than being the star of the show who gets to come in and counsel a CEO. You've got to be your own CEO. And that's complex. And if you've never done it before, it's a huge learning curve. So a lot of people who have an entrepreneurial itch should really test that out within their own company. Like, see if you can be an entrepreneur, work on a project, work on a team, do something different, get P&L responsibility, whatever you can do to really understand what it's like to have ownership of a business. Because once you got it, man, it's daunting. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question on that. Do you feel as though the entrepreneurial move that you did, do you see that as a career path? Because I see that, you know, if you watch social media, it's a big thing to where folks are thinking career is corporate only.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurial is separate. Well, no, it's still a career choice in my mind. I'm like, that's a career choice. And to your point, don't think it's going to be any, you're going to work any less. You're going to make more after, you know, 30, 60, 90 days out. Like, boom, here are the customers. I'm at six figures. I'm going to post it online.
No way.
No.
You need 2 to 3 years of your salary ideally stocked away because you're not going to make any money for a year, you know? And then the other thing is you're now paying your own taxes. You've got your own overhead. You know, I can't tell you how many people have asked me to fax them things in the past decade. And I'm like, what? You're a Fortune 100 company? You want me to fax you something? All right. I got to drive to Kinko's. I mean, I'm an intern. So there's a really great author out there by the name of Gino Wickman, G-I-N-O Wickman. And Gino writes about the difference between someone who owns a business and someone who's an entrepreneur. And there are individuals out there like me who own a business, but true entrepreneurs are always building, right? They're building an empire. They're building towards something. And I would say as I get older, I'm less entrepreneurial and I'm more like, let me just run my little business right here. I just need this little piece of the pie. But entrepreneurs really want to create a legacy. They want to change the world. And I want to provide goods and services. So I don't really call myself an entrepreneur anymore now that I understand that differentiation, but it's pretty interesting because Gino Wickman argues that entrepreneurs have a DNA and they will never be satisfied in a corporate job. So if you're satisfied getting a paycheck, but you just don't like your boss, don't jump into the world of being an entrepreneur. Find a different way, find a different career path, find a different company, but don't just go out and hang a shingle because you may not be happy.
So in that definition from Gino Wickman, that's when we look at the Elon Musk of the world and those folks who are just build something. He went from PayPal, Tesla, the rocket, what's coming next?
Or what about a local entrepreneur who's putting up a bunch of dry cleaning stores?
Right.
Or someone who's really interested in Froyo? Or somebody who owns a lot of different franchises. That's also somebody who's an entrepreneur, right? We have a new franchise in our area called Crumble Cookies. And I'm always amazed when somebody franchises. That's too complex for me and just beyond my appetite to do that. But that's someone who's dreaming because they don't just want one Crumble cookie. They want seven of them, right? You know? And I think that's really beautiful and admirable, but it's not for everybody. So within self-employment, what I'm saying is there's a lot of different ways to go, but definitely it's all a career choice. It's all a career path. Unless you're individually wealthy, you got to work. And at least at a company, you have 1 to 2 bosses. When you're self-employed, you know, I have 15 bosses, including my husband.
Right, right. That's a huge wake-up call. I'm glad we went down there. So, looking at the learning piece,
yes.
Number three, break that down. Is that learning more, and it may be encompassing all what you're saying, sure. Learning more of the craft you're in, or getting more of a acumen, just overall professional business acumen? What's that learning path, or how you break that
sure.
down?
Well, I believe all learning is worthwhile. And sometimes companies tend to focus on learning that will benefit them in the next 18 to 24 months. And I think you, as a consumer of work, but more importantly, as a human being, deserve to be learning and growing all the time. All learning is worthwhile because it's really developing that muscle and giving you a good perspective on the world so that you can be open to other learning opportunities that come your way. So whenever I work with someone who's really bored or really hates their job, you know, we really explore like what's something you can learn that doesn't have anything to do with your job, but can just add a little like zhuzh to your day, like you might get excited about. So, you know, I've had people learn how to make bacon. I've had people learn how to ice skate. And, you know, I found myself during COVID really doubling down on my job like a little too much. And so now I'm learning how to work a DSLR camera. I don't know how to work a DSLR camera, right? I don't have any idea, but I'm going to take classes from a friend of mine. I've been watching YouTube videos on getting the settings right. And I think what I'm driving towards is that there's all different kinds of learning. All of it's worthwhile, but the best and the brightest people in the world put 10 to 15 minutes on their calendar every day and go learn. That could be a TED Talk. That could be talking to someone in a different department at your organization. That could be, you know, going on LinkedIn learning and learning something. It doesn't have to be expensive, but it's just about using your brain in a different way. Mm. And not, again, relying on your HR department to put a prescriptive learning path in front of you. While that's terrific, that's very rare. And any learning path your company gives you generally involves them, and it may not be aligned with who you are and where you want to be in 5 years. So why not explore and be creative? You know, you want to take a yoga class, or I don't know, kids around here are rollerblading. I don't know when that came back, but they're, you know, and their parents are rollerblading. I'm like, oh, how do you rollerblade? I'm curious about this. So I missed this in the 90s. So yeah, all learning is worthwhile. That's what I believe.
So I like what you said there about that prescriptive learning that the employer will put in front of you.
Yeah.
Is there a way that you see that and like, you know what? Yeah, 5 years, this is not the path I want to take. Can I sit down with my manager and kind of customize my career path? Say, look, instead of going straight accounting payable to staff accountant to whatever, CPA to, you know, CFO, I might want to go marketing.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Well, you know, it can be a great conversation to have with an open-minded manager who recognizes that no talent is going to be there in 5 years. That's not the way the world works. And they just want you to feel engaged and to learn and to do your best work. And maybe you'll be there if they can retain you in a different capacity. It can be fraught with complications if your manager is old school and they're like, can't you do what you're told? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I like the pre-mortem. Like, what could go wrong with that conversation? I would list all the different ways. Maybe your boss is skeptical. Maybe your boss thinks you're trying to get an education for free to go work at a competitor. What can you say? What can you do? How can you make a marketing course relevant in your world of accounting? There are all different ways to play this, but it requires preparation on your part and really understanding your manager and their prime motivation and what they're going to get out of the conversation.
Right. Right. And that's taking a huge risk, right?
It is. But, you know, nobody ever got fired for asking to learn something new. That's the other thing. Orlando, you know this industry. You know how hard it is to fire people. And there are all these people walking around going, I can't ask for a day off. I might get fired. Who has ever been fired for asking for a day off? Who has ever been fired for going to the doctor, right? This does not happen. These are the stories we tell ourselves. And I suspect that if someone in accounting wanted to take a marketing class, they would throw that person a party. You know, like, go take it.
Awesome. So well-being, big in it. And we're talking, and when I hear that term well-being, I'm thinking mental health, physical health, right? To be prime and functioning in your role or whatever venture in your day-to-day life. How important is the well-being in your career?
Boy, well-being is everything, isn't it? We've learned that with COVID. But one of the things I talk about in the book and also in my speaking is financial well-being. And I'm not talking enrolling people in financial literacy courses, because generally speaking, most people know how to manage their money. There's just not enough of it. Healthcare costs are high. Housing costs are insane. We now have gas, right? As people start to return to work, gas is higher. All kinds of complexities in this world. And we also know that people who have poor physical and mental health outcomes also often have financial issues. Like, they all seem to go hand in hand. And so when I work with HR departments, I'm like, if you want to make people feel better, if you really want to improve the physical and emotional well-being of your organization, make sure you make a commitment to equal pay for equal work. Because you'll raise the standard of living for so many people in the workforce. You will make them feel secure at that very bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, and you will then give them a foundation to go pursue their physical health, their mental health, right? But they can't do it if they're broke and they're worried about electricity bills or tuition payments or medical bills. So financial well-being is the underpinning of all of this. If you're working, but you're not earning enough, What's the point? Of course, that's going to make you feel terrible. So that's my message out there. The connection is so interwoven, and that's not just me, that's science. So HR can make a difference by working on that.
Great point. Phenomenal point. So self-leadership, you called it.
I did.
Okay. Let's dissect that. I love that, because I've never heard the term put it in that way, you know, self-accountability, things like that. But when you say self-leadership, I think it takes on this whole new perception and a higher level of accountability than we naturally put on ourselves. So what does that look like?
Well, you know, we have been taught for generations that there's daddy CEO, and then, you know, the family of VPs who are in charge, and then HR at many corporations is like mom, and expected to behave, but these are the people who are really going to set strategy and set the values of the organization. And if things fall apart, we need to look to leadership to fix it. And clearly, that's not true. I mean, all of us are adults in our own lives. We go home, we raise children, we pay mortgages, we do all of these things where we show leadership on a daily basis. And then we come to work and we look to our crazy CEO to give us guidance. And already we're in a position where we're victims or we're imposters, right? We're not acting like the adults that we are. So I believe in individual accountability, which means showing up with hard work, like actually doing the thing you were paid to do, being resilient, knowing that even in the best organizations, nothing goes well all the time, and really demonstrating competencies, like leaning into the fact that you're hired to do a job. You know what you're doing. Just do it. You know, my favorite story, I got to hear Sarah Blakely, who's the CEO of a company called Spanx. And Sarah was working with a young millennial, and the millennial was like freaking out, like they used to do in a very stereotypical way. And like, oh, Sarah, I don't know what to do. What do you think? And Sarah said, I want you to do your job as if I weren't here. Boom. So that requires someone to demonstrate critical thinking, to understand how to take a risk, maybe use the pre-mortem, right? To really think through, what do I know? What are the skills that I brought to this job? And then to work incredibly hard. So when I talk about self-leadership, I talk about all of that. It's the art and science of individual accountability. And really, we've got someone like Nelson Mandela, who for years was held captive in South Africa by the apartheid government. And no matter how he was treated, he always treated his captors with respect and dignity, even if it wasn't afforded to him. He chose his attitude. And I don't expect everybody to be Nelson Mandela. I'm not Nelson Mandela, right? But it's something to think about, that you have control over your attitude and your emotions, even in the darkest circumstances. And, you know, by the way, then we have Michael Jordan, right, who complicated human being, but also showed up, and his practice wasn't just practice. He showed up with a work ethic, and he wasn't intimidated by failure. He's like, you know what? Failure is part of the process. I'm going to de-escalate this, and I'm just going to perform to the best of my ability. He leaned into his competencies. There are so many examples out there, and there are examples of self-leadership gone the wrong way. You know, like a Tony Robbins would just berate you, right? And say, oh, suck it up. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than just sucking it up, right? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, okay, do I even have bootstraps, Tony? All right, slow down. Right. So that guy is toxic. And also someone like Tiger Woods, you know, he's brilliant, amazing at his game, but he always has his critics in his ear or his dad in his ear. He's not leaning into his competencies. He's always like questioning himself. And in that way, Tiger Woods has been amazing in his career, but he's also had incredible challenges because he gets distracted by all sorts of things. So there are good examples of self-leadership and then there are examples to avoid. And as much as I like Tiger Woods, he's not an example of self-leadership.
Got it. I love that. Jim Rohn, and I'm sure you heard the quote, he says, just get, you know, do more than what they pay you for. So I love that quote because it has nothing to do with the organization. It's just developing your work ethic, your craft, and just being a better person. So, you know, long term, you're developing this yourself in a space that you can produce no matter where you go. You're just bringing such a massive accountability and work ethic that it's unchanged no matter where you go, because
you know what I would take. Yes, I love that. And I would take somebody who just showed up and did their job some days, like even that would be an improvement. So like, give me that.
Be amazing. Right, let's start there. Right. So that's awesome. So let's pivot to the workplace, right? The future of work. As you do speaking, as you talk to clients, what are you hearing out there now? In terms of what they're going to see post-pandemic, if there ever is going to be a post-pandemic.
Good question. You know, everybody's still stuck in this conversation. Well, it's a big conversation around hybrid, remote, back to work, also tied in with vaccinations and compelling people to be vaccinated. I think for talented people, they're going to be in a really great position to ask for a lot. You know, if you can demonstrate that you can deliver a lot, that you have self-leadership, individual accountability, that you take care of yourself and you're not looking for the company to like deal with your drama, you can write your check. And I think it's going to be an exciting time for people who show up with confidence and clarity and know what they offer. For people who are desperate for work and feel like they're not in control, because that's the message they give to themselves, employers are going to run rapshod over that. They're going to say, all right, you know, come on board. And these are the rules, like it or lump it. And I think in that way, I'm a little bit worried because I want the workforce to be confident and assured that they deserve a great paycheck, that they deserve safe working conditions, and that we're not just going to go back to 2019. Who survived a pandemic just to live like we lived a couple of years ago? We should all be moving forward and improving. So I think this weird world of talent still is going to shake itself out. But I don't know. I'm excited for people who are confident. And I think CEOs are actually kind of excited about that from what I'm hearing, because they want people who they don't have to worry about, you know, that they believe in. So if you're someone who's amazing, bring it and don't be shy.
So that's interesting what you said. So you're saying that there are obviously some employers who's going to take advantage of the situation.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Get talent for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, of course.
They're seeing their fear in their eyes and they see blood in the water.
That's right. They're like, oh, you barely survived the pandemic and you were broke or you lost your job or you're scared or you need health insurance. They'll play the poor card themselves. Well, even the corporate earnings have never been higher in many of these industries and they all got their PPP loans, you know. We can't afford, you know, we're going to give you the lowest dollar possible. And what we're finding now is that really talented people are saying, show me the money. So it's going to be interesting.
Wow. And that's bad.
I'm cynical. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, for the employers who actually take that path, and that humanize the situation a bit to say, hey, we get it. Because a lot of people are, right? There are self-evaluating and thinking, maybe this nursing industry is not for me anymore. And now I want to pivot left and pivot right. So markets are going to be, it may be a situation, again, I'm just speaking out the top of my head, that there may be some robbing Peter to pay Paul in terms of a lot of folks jumping industries.
Agreed.
Because they had a self-evaluation, right? There was that self-awakening.
That's right.
To be like, wow, this is really not the life I want going forward.
That's right.
And that employers would really take advantage of that now when the climate is not the time to do it. Like this is a, and I get it. Any market that goes bad, there's always somebody making a dollar from it, right?
So yeah. It'll be interesting to see how these things shake out. But if I know anything about running a small business, and I know a little something, nobody likes to pay for labor and talent, like unless they have to. So give them a reason to pay you is what I'm saying. Don't let them play the card that they don't have the budget. Because if they don't have the budget, then you're not for the company. You know, if they don't have the benefits you want, don't go work there. Do not sacrifice. You're smart, you're talented, you should ask for what you want and get it. That's like the lesson of the pandemic. Bet on yourself, right? Yeah.
So what's that conversation like for a confident person? If you've spoken with anyone, what tactics are they taking? What research are they doing? And how are they coming to the table and saying, look, X, you need X, I can deliver X, I'm worth X.
I have a lot of my friends in this world who are currently looking for work. And so first of all, they're being discriminating around where they're even applying. I think that's really important. You know, they're doing their research online, they're talking to individuals, and they're actually using LinkedIn to connect with existing employees. You know, like, what do you think? And who do you know? Or we know so-and-so in common. Can you give me the scoop? So I think these conversations are happening enabled by social media. And I'm like super encouraged about that, because one of the things we saw with Me Too and with Black Lives Matter is that social media accelerated these honest conversations. Right. So I think as we start to reopen the economy and things start to take off, social media will continue to be an important tool to talk about real world work experiences. Like more than ever, that's going to be important. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. But yeah, it's very common in my own peer group for people to just be brave, be bold, and connect with people online. So
awesome. So I want to also touch on something you said earlier. Sure. Well, actually just a couple of minutes ago about some employers being excited.
Yeah.
About capturing confident employees.
Totally.
What is that? What are they thinking? Again, if you've heard those conversations of friends, what is that like?
I have heard those conversations with VPs, with hiring managers, that they are so blown away when someone comes in with poise and with confidence, and they talk about what they can deliver on the job, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. They're totally and completely just authentic, and not in a selfish way, but they talk about who they are and what they can offer to the organization. It's a breath of fresh air when you don't come in and play the interview game. You know, like, what are your greatest strengths and weaknesses? You can actually say, you know, I got a lot of strengths, I got a lot of weaknesses. Let me give you an example of a time that one of those really shone through, right? Like, you can get down to having a real conversation. You don't have to play that game. And I think more and more, I was just having a conversation with a VP of marketing who's interviewing right now. And the people who resonate with her are those individuals who are straight talking, direct, and also concise. They just don't have a lot of time for this. They don't want to go through 5 interviews. So right off the bat, they ask questions like, how many interviews am I going to have to go through? Do you post the salary requirements, right? You can ask these questions and it's not a red flag at the right organization. It shows confidence.
Yeah, I love that point, and I love that it's happening too. And I try to tell folks all the time that the interview process should be a conversation, not an interrogation. You have just as much power. Don't feel as though you're in the hot seat. This is right. This is a marriage. You're talking. Who knows your commitment level? You're going to be there for the next several years. Yeah. You need to find out who you're going to partner with. Right.
That's huge.
So, with that, talk about some of the things you're working on now. How are you helping folks in this space with leadership, well-being, learning? Taking risk, and also, do you have an opportunity? Are you talking with companies? Like, what does that look like for organizations? Because this is huge that it can be implemented for companies and their principals.
That's right.
To attract better talent.
Yeah. So I do quite a bit of coaching work, you know, individually with leaders. So that's kind of like the bread and butter of my business, especially now that I'm not speaking like I used to, right? Like COVID threw us all for a loop and my speaking business is a little bit different than it was a year and a half ago. So, but I do go and talk to organizations about these ideas. I talk to affinity groups, you know, leadership teams, and really try to challenge them about thinking about what is it like if you have an employee who asks for what she wants? Like, let's talk through that. Like, let's actually role play this because it can be interesting. So those are the kind of talks that I do for these leadership teams. But more importantly, I'm working on my next book. So I'm a little busy. So I'm like working on that. I'm having a good time with that. And I'm writing about, so I'll just share with you, I don't talk about this widely, writing about corporate drinking cultures. Yeah. Yeah. And what it means to truly bond and have team building and to get along with people and how alcohol can help, but also how it often doesn't. And let me tell you, you think like, well, are people still drinking? They're drinking more than ever on Zoom. So they're having Zoom happy hours and trying to connect with one another. And they're working in the middle of the day with a glass of champagne on their desk. So the drinking culture is alive and well, and I'm exploring it. So that's the next one.
So what I got from what you just said, with talking with leaders, is that you're actually shifting their mindset more, right?
Yeah.
So that's a task in itself.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I think they're sick and tired of the old playbook around leadership development. And I think they're ready for the message around self-leadership. Mm. Like, it's so refreshing to not have to babysit an employee.
Yeah.
It's so refreshing to have an employee actually use the employee assistance program when they have mental health issues instead of having a breakdown in the office and waiting for other people to solve it. Right. It's amazing when they use their health insurance and take good care of themselves and take a day for a doctor's appointment, right? So we're trying to flip the script that way and talk about how an independent worker, someone who knows themselves and knows who they are, can still collaborate, can still be part of a team, but they don't have to look to you like you're a parent. You know, they can look to you like you're a coach or an advisor, which is what a boss in 2021 really is. A boss in 2021 is not someone who lays the law down. It's supposed to be someone who is advising you on how to get what you want in this world and solve problems. So that's what I'm talking about.
That sounds like a book in itself right there.
I tried to write that book. So hopefully Betting on You delivers on some of that. So yeah,
that's pretty powerful, because I think the overarching view of still right now 2021 is that bosses are laying the law down.
Those bosses are dumb.
You heard it first here, Career Talks from
Laurie. And tired. No wonder the bosses have the highest levels of disengagement anywhere in the organization, and that's because they're doing the wrong work. Yeah.
What work should they be doing? The work of the people, meaning
work of the people. Engagement. Yeah. Clearing the path, advising, solving problems at a higher level, and staying out of the minutiae. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. Cool. I love that. So it's also an uncovering of, because you talk about it, it's really self-awareness, right? A lot of self-awareness. And I wonder, like, I would love to be a fly on the wall when you're having those conversations with the executive, and that can become a therapy session for them to be like, you know what, look, I've been dealing with this for so long.
Orlando,
I'm having my own, and I'm the VP. Like, who do I go to?
They go to me. It's all therapy. I have a stipulation in my contract that if I think somebody needs therapy, our relationship ends and they go to therapy, because I cannot offer that. And so I'm happy to do it together in conjunction with the therapist, but you wouldn't believe how many times I've had to invoke that. So, you know, people need an outlet, and sometimes they need a professional outlet, and sometimes they need a doctor, you know, who can write a prescription. So there's no shame in that.
And do you think that the higher they go in corporate, the bigger the outlet needed because of the pressure potentially?
Yeah, I think especially, so I deal a lot with professional women, and professional women have a very difficult time. Although there are all these networking groups and affinity groups, they have a very difficult time being vulnerable and being authentic. So they need a way to kind of vent and to talk through some things in a way that's safe. And so I offer that.
That's wonderful. So I want to be mindful of your time. I told you before we came on, 45 minutes. And I want to.
And you did it. You're professional.
Absolutely. Any last parting words for professional women out there?
Yeah, well, I'm just real grateful to have an opportunity to share ideas out in the world. I don't necessarily think that my ideas are right about the world of work. They're just a set of ideas, but I would welcome anybody to have a look, you know, go get my book at a small bookstore. Jeff Bezos doesn't need any more money. Go to a library, right, if you're curious and don't want to spend the $20. But I would love to connect with people on LinkedIn, wherever. So check out the book, connect with me, and let's have a conversation.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much, Lori. Don't go away. I'm going to close this out and then a quick chat, and then I will let you enjoy your afternoon. But thank you again, everybody. Buy the book, Betting on You by Lori Ruderman. She is amazing. You heard it here. That's it.
Thank you.